The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Healthy Lifestyle with Lorianne is brought to you by Northwell Health. Visit them online at northwell.edu. Welcome to Healthy Lifestyle. I'm Lorianne Kazdia. Our goal at Healthy Lifestyle is to inspire, educate, and empower you to fulfill a healthy, emotional, spiritual, and physical life so you can feel empowered to live the life you have always wanted and dreamed. So today, other than having a bout of laryngitis, as you can hear, we have on with us someone who coined a great phrase. It says, be heart smart, prevent the event. Love, love, love that. We have with us today Dr. Guy Mintz. He is the Director of Cardiovascular Health and Lipidology at North Shore University Hospital. He's also co-director of the Lipid Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Lori.
So here's the obvious question for me, because I had never heard of this before, is so what's a lipid and what does the Lipid Center do?
A lipid refers to cholesterol particles in the body. That could be your cholesterol. It could also be triglycerides, which are fats. And the Lipid Center works in a collaborative approach with your primary care physicians, endocrinologists, other cardiologists, to work together in the patient interest to lower their cardiovascular risk by managing their lipid panel, for one, and their other cardiac risk factors.
Now, how does what you do differ than me going to my regular care doctor, my internist, or my cardiologist?
So just like a diabetic patient may require an endocrinology consult at some point, we're specialists in the area of cholesterol lipidology with added training, expertise, and board certification just in this area. And as I said earlier, we're working with your physicians to help manage your overall cardiovascular risk. We also have experience with the advanced medications in this area, the PCSK9 injectables, and other medications that your primary care physician may not have access to.
So who is the best patient for you?
We have a variety of patients that we're seeing. That could be the patient that does not want to be on cholesterol medications. That could be the patient that has a family history of early heart disease. That could be the patient that has a prior history of a heart attack or stroke or peripheral arterial disease. It could be a patient with diabetes. It could be a patient that's perfectly healthy but genetically has a predisposition to high cholesterol. It could be a patient with elevated markers of inflammation in their bloodstream, which is C-reactive protein. And as I said, it's people that are perfectly healthy, people that have had clinical events, and people with diabetes.
Understood. So you opened the center September 2019, right?
Yes.
It's in Great Neck, right?
Yes.
Okay. And it's the first of its kind on Long Island, correct?
Yes, the first lipid center on Long Island, taking care of patients in Nassau, Suffolk, Queens, Brooklyn, and Staten Island. I work with my co-director, Dr. Benjamin Hirsch, to evaluate our patients. And the other factors that we have which make it a center is we have a registered dietitian that provides our nutritional counseling. We have cardiogeneticists that look at patients that have predisposition to high cholesterol. So it's a total comprehensive evaluation of the patients. And then we get back to the referring doctor, whether it's another cardiologist, a primary care physician, or endocrinologist, to develop a plan with them and keeping them in the loop and taking care of their patients.
Understood. Now, I have always been under the impression, based on information I have, that a heart episode is different for men and women. The first question is that accurate? And then the second question is women's heart disease and risk factors, what would those be specifically?
All right. I think that's a great question. So let me just preface
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me preface that by saying that heart disease is the leading cause of death in men and women in the United States. And the first symptom of a heart attack in half the cases is a heart attack. And heart disease is the leading cause of death in men and women. So women in general seek a lot of their primary care either from their gynecologists or primary care physicians, who certainly are not as up to date with cholesterol evaluation and cardiac risk factor evaluation as others. And women may present more commonly with shortness of breath rather than chest pain. And statistics and a variety of studies now over the last few years have shown that up to 40% of women are not on cholesterol medicine when they should be, or not on the correct dose of cholesterol medicine. So again, in looking at their overall risk, they're not being treated as aggressively as they should be. And physicians themselves are partially guilty. They may not be asking the right questions or feel that heart disease appears later in life in women than men, and just negate some of the other things that need to be looked at in that gender.
So just to make sure I'm hearing it correctly, and for our listeners, we should probably go to a cardiologist as opposed to our GYN to get evaluated for where our heart situation is and whether or not we need to be on meds, right?
Well, I think, the answer is you can start with your primary care physician, whether it's your family doctor or internist. That would start the ball rolling and see, look at your overall profile, and then certainly can be referred to a cardiologist to further that risk. And then again, in our specialty, if you look at, what we do, certain cardiologists who are interventional cardiologists put in stents and they do angioplasty. Those are called invasive cardiologists. Then you have surgeons that do coronary artery bypass surgeries. But that group of patients, they're basically redesigning the plumbing. They're working on one area. When we talk about atherosclerosis or atherosclerotic risk, it affects the entire vascular tree. So in our specialty, we're looking at affecting the natural history of the disease rather than looking at one particular area that gets fixed when the rest of the tree of blood vessels are affected by the process.
You said something earlier that you should go to your primary care doctor. I'm aware that many women statistically go to their GYN as their primary doctor. I don't really think that that's necessarily the best idea. Maybe an internist, a cardiologist, or the lipid center, yes?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think, gynecologists are specialists in gynecology. They're not specialists in internal medicine or family practice, and certainly not specialized in cardiology or cardiovascular risk assessment. So I totally agree with you.
So this is... we should really try to avoid that first heart attack or stroke, obviously. But if we don't have any symptoms to alert us of the situation, then this is a real important evaluation to get. Is this an annual thing? Do you do this every 2 years, every 5 years? What is your recommendation for that?
In terms of your physical exam, you should be checking in with your internist, your primary care physician, family doctor or cardiologist once a year. In terms of, what we do cardiovascular risk assessment, which is based on looking at blood tests, blood pressure, different things, again, as a collaborative or as a partner with the primary care physicians, right, to determine patient's overall risk. So certainly once a year, you should be seeing someone who, focuses on the overall medical health.
And for those of the listeners who are currently on meds, just because you're on meds doesn't mean you're at the right dose, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The other group of patients that we see are patients that are on medications, but they're not at cholesterol goal, they're not at triglyceride goal, their overall cardiovascular risk has not been reduced, and there's not a lot of inertia for many primary care physicians, and some cardiologists do not increase the dose to get these patients to goal. By the same token, there are a group of patients, 7 to 20% of patients, that are not able to tolerate an increase in statins or can't tolerate statins, which are the main medications for cholesterol. And these patients need to be reevaluated on a regular basis to see where they are in terms of their numbers and their overall cardiovascular risk.
On that line, there are new cholesterol guidelines that are risk-enhancing factors, and some are very unique for women. And I keep harping on women. I know it's important for men, too, but it's very unique for women, correct? Could you help us with that?
Yeah, so the new guidelines for cholesterol came out in 2018, and they included what's called risk-enhancing features that should be looked at in each individual. Some are unique to women, such as early menopause, such as polycystic ovary disease, such as pregnancy-induced hypertension. Some are unique to other disease states that you wouldn't think about increasing risk for cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, and such as psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, chronic kidney disease. So these are other patients that wouldn't necessarily be thought of it as increased cardiovascular risk. So I think it's important for us to get the word out, educate our colleagues to acknowledge this group of patients that are at higher risk. And again, as you correctly noted, certainly the female population subgroup has higher risk than others based on their history.
And for cardiac prevention, is it still part of these guidelines, aspirin for everyone?
And aspirin actually has become a little controversial in the last 2 years because certainly the group of patients that have had an event such as a heart attack or stroke benefit from being on aspirin therapy. The group that are totally asymptomatic and taking an aspirin for prevention should be looked at as a case-by-case basis because some studies came out in the last 2 years showing that the benefit of aspirin is negated by increased risk for bleeding. So I always say to patients, do not stop your aspirin, do not stop your medication until you discuss it with the doctor based on your overall risk. A lot of patients will see a quick article in the newspaper, oh, aspirin's not beneficial, they'll discontinue it. So aspirin is beneficial for certain groups of patients, and that discussion needs to take place between the patient and their physician.
Understood. So now there's inflammation. How does that relate to heart disease?
Inflammation refers to, in general terms, upsetting the milieu. So within your arteries, there's plaque buildup, cholesterol buildup over time. And the buildup doesn't go 40%, 70%, 90% heart attack. The buildup goes 20%, 40%, 50%. And the most common blockage that causes a heart attack is a 50% obstruction, an obstruction that doesn't benefit from angioplasty or stenting. Certainly, we put in stents for patients with more aggressive disease, 75, 80, 90%, and so on. So it gets back down to what other things contribute to upsetting the milieu or the internal aspect of the artery, and inflammation is one of them. Whether it's from a systemic disease such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, or whether someone has a genetic predisposition to be more inflamed, that's actually detected by a blood test called high sensitivity C-reactive protein, which is a routine blood test now that patients can get when they get their routine physical.
Does the doctor prescribe that, or do I, as a patient, have to ask for something like that?
I think for patients seeing their primary care physicians, it's a request. For the cardiologists, I think many are doing it as a routine blood panel. So it's called high sensitivity C-reactive protein, or CRP, and that's a marker for inflammation.
So using aspirin is obviously preventing heart events, but does sleep have an impact on heart health?
Sure.
Studies. Or a sedentary lifestyle?
Yes, actually, all of the above. So, you know, it's important to get up and move. We talk about 40 minutes four times a week. I call that my rule of fours. 40 minutes of continuous aerobic exercise four times a week have been shown to lower cholesterol, lower blood pressure, lower weight, and improve cardiovascular health. We can measure that in minutes of moderate exercise to more vigorous exercise. But sleep is important. Studies have come out in the last year showing that patients that do not get enough sleep are at increased risk for a heart attack. And you want to get at least 6 hours of sleep. 8 hours is better. And by getting enough sleep, you are going to be able to certainly reduce risk. So sleep and increased risk for heart attack have been correlated. Another area that causes increased risk for heart attacks and strokes and arrhythmias, irregular heartbeats, is sleep apnea, which is different, but also can contribute to sleep deprivation. So if you're getting up frequently in the middle of the night, or you're not getting enough hours sleep for whatever reason, you increase your risk for heart disease.
Understood, because it puts more work on the heart, right? What's that rule of four again?
40 minutes of continuous aerobic exercise four times a week gives you four benefits. So that's my rule of fours. 40 minutes, four times a week of continuous aerobic activity gives you four benefits. Lower blood pressure, lower weight, lower blood sugar, lower cholesterol. So patients can remember that. And, you know, if they say they're working and they're too busy, certainly they're maybe off Saturday and Sunday. That's 2 days a week they can, you know, walk. Everybody gets a lunch hour, so you can take half your lunch hour and start walking.
So it doesn't have to be vigorous. It just has to be continuous.
Continuous, correct. And you walk at a, you know, a reasonable pace.
Why did you become a cardiologist?
To fix broken hearts or hearts at risk.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Let's see, that's a tagline.
I love your why.
Well, again, we've come a long way. If you would go back to the 1960s, if someone had a heart attack, all we could do is just put them in the coronary care unit for a month and convalesce. And we've moved from recognizing disease to now how can we prevent it. So we know a lot more about the natural history of the process, and that's why something unique as a lipid center becomes important as an adjunct to what our physicians do for us on a daily basis.
And how long have you been a cardiologist?
Oh, 30 years.
Wow. Wow. So all on Long Island, serving Long Island?
Yes. I started my training back in 1984, and I opened up my original practice in 1989.
So you have about, what, 30 years of clinical experience?
Yes, ma'am.
That's something to sneeze at. That's a lot of experience. That's good. So the first lipid center on Long Island, you give the patients in this area greater access to a real focused cardiac risk evaluation and treatment, yeah?
Yes, true. And we also have clinical trials going on with some of the advanced medications. And as I said, there's a unique group of medications now called PCSK9, which are twice a month injectables to lower cholesterol and also lower cardiovascular risk. So we have a lot of expertise with that family of medications, and certainly with our nurse practitioners and our team in place, have increased access for patients to get these medications because they require pre-approval process from insurance and coverage.
If you had one thing that you would want all of our listeners to hear and or know, what would that be?
I think it's important to live a healthy lifestyle. So I think the first thing we talk about is eating right, moving well, moving often. And I think that's very important. As you heard me say earlier, sleep becomes important. But saying that, there are risk factors that we've identified, such as high blood pressure. With the new guidelines for blood pressure, one-third of Americans have high blood pressure. So patients do have risk factors. And if we realize again that the first symptom of a heart attack half the time is the actual heart attack, there's stuff we can do to negate that risk. Now, if I sent you to Vegas and I said you had a 40% chance of winning at the tables, you would take that. If you came into my office and said, I can give you a 40% chance of reducing your risk for a heart attack, I hope you would take that. But it's collaborative. We're not just a bunch of pill pushers. We're a bunch of lifestyle changers. So that's why it takes a team. And as I said, myself with Dr. Hirsch, our registered dietitian, nurse practitioners, we have a whole team in place to help patients identify their risk, understand their risk. And I'm a big proponent of everybody needs to understand everything so we row in the same direction. If we don't pull together, patients won't be listening. And we could be talking, but at the end of the day, we won't succeed. And the other message would be, this is an opportunity for us to affect the natural history of disease rather than just fixing one part of a diseased vessel or one part of a diseased artery somewhere.
So you're more than just giving meds if that's not necessary, and you could do it utilizing nutritional factors and other factors. You would definitely put that in the mix if it makes sense for that particular patient.
Yes, I said the first group of patients that we see are patients that don't want to be on medications.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all about that. So, and the other group, which we didn't really talk about, are patients that have a family history of early heart disease or heart attack. So if mom and dad had a clinical event, a first degree relative before the age of 60, you know, we want to know you. And we want to look at your risk factors, because I could negate other risk factors. I can't negate your genetics.
Yeah.
So that means we have to work everything around that. So yeah, the most common patient we see doesn't want to be on medications, and we're all in on that.
I love it. So if they want to know more about the Lipid Center, they can make an appointment by calling you?
Yeah, they can call the Lipid Center number, which you have right there.
Which is 516-321-7455. That's 516-321-7455. I really love this information. Thank you so much for being on, Dr. Mintz. Really, really appreciate it, and love your Be Heart Smart, Prevent the Event.
Thank you, Lori, and I appreciate the opportunity to help people. Thank you.
Love that. Here on Healthy Lifestyle, we absolutely love that. This is Lorianne Kasdia from Healthy Lifestyle, and we will be right back. Lifestyle with Lorianne is brought to you by Northwell Health. Visit them online at northwell.edu. Welcome back to Healthy Lifestyle. I'm Lorianne. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas on topics or guests you'd like to hear more about, please email us at healthylifestylewithla@gmail.com. And of course, we ask you to follow us on social media at Healthy Lifestyle with LA. We love hearing from you and answer every email and post personally. Well, our second half, we're so excited. We have Dr. Kapoor back. Welcome back, Dr. Kapoor.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Dr. I'm going to mangle your name, but I'm going to try it. Dr. Karane.
Perfect.
Yes, I got that. They're all from Northwell Health. And there's actually a relationship between Northwell Health and Engel Bergman to bring this new medical center called Wellbridge, correct?
Correct.
I'm so excited about this. This is out in Calverton, and it is an addiction treatment facility. And I welcome you to the show as well, Doc.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here. I want to add that Wellbridge is not only an addiction treatment facility, but it's also a research center. And the vision that Northwell Health has been so warm and embracing is to create a center that becomes a hub, not only for supporting many families and individuals struggling with addiction throughout Long Island, but also a hub for education and advancing the field of addiction and addiction care.
And you are providing care for opioids as well, because not all facilities do on Long Island.
Yes, we will be focusing on the broad spectrum of substance use related issues. Commonly that includes opioids, alcohol, cocaine, to name a few. But hand in hand with addiction often are what are called co-occurring disorders, which include psychiatric conditions and other medical conditions, which we also will have a really dynamic team in place to be able to handle.
So I'm going to back you up for a second, because this is very exciting to me. When someone is addicted to something, it's generally thought, the general thought is, it's as a result of avoidance of something else, and or they just, it's a lack of coping mechanisms, right? And so they may become addicted to alcoholism or become alcoholic, could become addicted to opioids or other drugs. So you're going to be really serving on a holistic basis, the entire human, meaning that if it is relative to some kind of an event or situation, you're also going to treat that?
Correct. The most effective approaches that we have to treat addiction today involve what are called patient-centric approaches, where we're taking the whole individual and trying to address all of their needs. At Wellbridge, as in residential inpatient treatment facility, we're hoping that it creates an environment that folks can mobilize a number of different types of skills and supports that are then durable long after they leave our facility. I think broadly in addiction treatment today, what happens after folks leave care,
yes,
is where there's a lot to be desired. And particularly in Long Island, we're hopeful that Wellbridge becomes a really valuable asset to many families and many communities. And that is also why partnering with Northwell Health is a tremendous resource for us.
Dr. Kapoor, you've seen a lot of this, obviously, because you're the head of the correct me, the opioid division preventative care, correct?
Sure. So the screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment program.
Thank you. That's what I meant to say.
Yep.
So with that, you've seen a lot of this. And talk about the advantages of this marriage between Northwell and Wellbridge.
I think there's tremendous synergies and advantages. You know, while we are in the process of still trying to figure out the right way to address substance use as part of usual care, the reality is that patients need help. Families need help with this chronic condition. And up until recently, the thought was that you need to leave the local area out of state to receive high-level care. And unfortunately, you know, it's not usually evidence-based care. So for the population that, you know, lower New York represents, having a local, high-quality, evidence-based facility that's really deep-rooted in providing compassionate care with evidence and science to back it, like you said, in a holistic way, it's a no-brainer. And I think it's a real big win for our local community that pretty much is seeing the downstream effects of our industry at large not always doing the right thing by patients dealing with substance use disorder.
So is this a voluntary only type based facility? Is that what we're talking about here? We're still in that mode.
Yeah, I think, and we've discussed this before together on the show as well, that, you know, respecting one's autonomy, meaning their decision making and that of their families, is a big part of sustaining decisions, right? So it's one thing to force folks or demand that they stop using alcohol or drugs, but, you know, a simple analogy is, you know, ask a room full of people how many people drink coffee, and then ask them to raise their hand if we tell them never to drink it again tomorrow. You know, it may, you know, prevent some coffee utilization the next day, but sustaining that is hard.
So let's, I'm sorry to cut you off. Let's look at the balance here, though, because you keep mentioning the families of, which I definitely relate to. And being a family member of someone who is addicted to opioids, it's really frustrating. And when this happened to our family, there was no place for someone to dry out or come off of, whatever you want to call it, from the opioid. Matter of fact, one hospital actually gave them the opioid after we had spent 3 days trying to get them off of and detoxing from it. So how do you help the families who go through this? Because it's so impactful to everyone surrounding that individual who may or may not be making good choices. So how do we handle that?
It's a complex thing, right?
Yes.
But I think one, normalizing the conversation. So your experience is really no different than the experience myself and hundreds and thousands of other people have
right.
with their families.
Exactly.
And I think having dialogue about it is very important. I think having dialogue in a clinical or a hospital setting supported by members of a clinical team that are compassionate and understand is exponentially valuable. And then, you know, and Dr. Karani could speak on this, then actually building a care pathway or treatment plan that not only is revolving around the patient per se, but also there to support the family through this crisis.
Yeah, because how do you know, Doc, how do you know what to do as a family member? I don't mean to get away from the people who have the addiction and require the treatment, but the family, there was no place to turn. I didn't know what was right, what I was doing right, what I was doing wrong. I had no support. So how do you know?
So one of the biggest challenges, I think, that persists in our country is that addiction still remains in the shadows. There are a variety of resources that exist, certainly in Long Island, throughout New York State, that individuals and their families struggling with addiction often are not even aware of that are available. So to me, the very first step starts with education, looking to one of the easiest initial resources would obviously be the internet, but I would specifically steer folks towards well-established resources such as NIDA or SAMHSA, or within New York State, even the Department of Health has a variety of platforms where there's a list of resources within a given geographic area. And from there, at least, a conversation can start for the family member that's being impacted of where to turn to, whether that's for more specialized formal supports, like a place like Wellbridge, or much smaller first steps to find a support group, to connect with families that have gone through similar experiences or that are currently going through similar experiences. There's tremendous knowledge that can be gained through those processes. I think with that, though, comes really one of the biggest first challenges as a family starts to address a loved one's substance use issues. And that's retaining compassion for that individual. Because very often in the process of now addressing these really complex and challenging issues, a lot of new information starts to come out. And the plot thickens and gets a lot uglier. And so within that, it's essential that the family has ways to support themselves, their own self-care. And again, to me, I think education's at least the framework that allows for those processes to start to happen.
I think the most frustrating thing when I experienced it and when I'm speaking to other people who have experienced it is that when you have someone who doesn't want and think that they have a problem, that's really hard. And it's not a lack of compassion by the family members. It's a lack of resources because you have nowhere to go and they're just destroying your family. And, you know, what are the choices that you're left in? So there's a lot to contend with and a lot that you're dealing with. But just to kind of jump into a different direction, this facility is opening up. You what, had a groundbreaking last October 2018?
Correct.
And when do you expect it to actually open this facility? Because I'm really excited to see that we have these resources available now on Long Island, specifically in New York and definitely to the East Coast, have these kind of resources. So you expect to open?
We expect to open in March of 2020.
That's exciting.
We have 50 different processes unfolding every day. We're really excited by the progress of the construction, and that's a real credit to our partners at Engel Berman and their expertise. From the point of construction being completed, then we have a number of regulatory steps, I can speak to some of the entities that have already been engaged with our process, particularly OASAS, which is the main state regulatory entity for substance use care. They've been incredibly supportive of our efforts and in many ways are just so excited that a facility of this sort is being built in New York.
So walk us through, Wellbridge someplace other places in the country?
No.
This will be the first facility?
Correct.
Oh, that's wonderful. So walk us through what life will look like for someone who has some kind of substance use disorder. Walk us through what that will look like. What kind of support can they anticipate, both the person with the disorder and their family?
So, you know, you alluded to one of the most pressing challenges up front that unlike many other diseases or medical conditions, addiction is often marked by denial. And overcoming that initial resistance to accessing care still remains perhaps one of the most pressing issues in the domain of addiction care. Statistics across the nation suggest that only about 1 out of 10 individuals that could really benefit from addiction treatment ever accesses any form of treatment. And so Wellbridge, I think, fundamentally represents, to me, a ray of hope. It's an outlet for folks to get support, to get educated, and ultimately access care. Starts by first engaging families and engaging individuals struggling with substance use issues throughout the community. And that's where our partnership, particularly with Northwell Health, that has such a large footprint, I think now 9-10 million New Yorkers access care at Northwell facilities. And so by opening the conversation to addiction more broadly, I think the first step of engagement is where so many efforts are focused. The next step, though, is once folks actually come to the point that they're ready to enter care. An experience that we're hoping at Wellbridge is really like none other. We have really designed a very thoughtfully constructed and incredibly serene campus. There are many different programmatic levels at Wellbridge. And so the first phase of care involves a very rigorous medical assessment to determine what level of care someone would be most appropriate for. And then once they enter into that program, they'd be meeting with, again, an interdisciplinary team that includes a medical provider, addiction medicine specialist, psychiatrist, counselors, therapists, nurses, and from there, again, a very specific treatment plan is developed to address the needs of that individual.
Now, I had a question asked of me to ask you. Is there such a thing as e-cigarette addiction? And would this be included in this if it is?
So that's a...
As in like vaping?
Right. Yeah. So in the last several years, vaping has become a really unprecedented epidemic throughout our country. The most common underlying driver is nicotine. And so...
Even in vaping?
Even in vaping. Huh. Most e-cigarette products, vaping products, were originally intended to deliver nicotine. Where that story has gotten much, much more complex is that now a broad spectrum of THC compounds are introduced into the vape pods, as well as potentially many other chemicals and adulterants that can be deadly. And in the last year, we've seen, I think, now over 600 cases throughout the country of very, very serious pulmonary illnesses unfolding from either vaping nicotine products or THC products. Generally, the management of nicotine or THC use is something that's handled on an outpatient level.
Uh-huh.
So it's not something that usually leads for someone to seek inpatient addiction treatment. But at Wellbridge, we absolutely would want to be able to address all those issues for anyone that's coming into our care.
Understood. Thank you. And also, I had another question from our listeners, which is they're seeing that there's a usage trend shift from opioids to cocaine, and I should say back to cocaine. Is that accurate as well?
So usage patterns vary so much across the country, particularly looking within New York, Long Island. Opioids still remain an incredibly, incredibly pressing issue. One of the challenges that perhaps the listener was alluding to is that in the last 2 to 3 years, there have been increasing cases of cocaine that actually is adulterated with fentanyl.
Yes.
And that obviously poses a very serious threat, not only the hazards that can come from cocaine use, but now potentially concurrently having someone develop dependence to an opioid or overdosing and dying from fentanyl exposure.
Yeah.
And those are the ongoing challenge in the midst of the broader opioid crisis, where these patterns are far outpacing the treatment resources we have in place.
Understood. I really appreciate you being on Healthy Lifestyle. I'd love for you guys to come back in March. I have a gazillion other questions for you, as do our listeners. So I would really love to have you back. Appreciate your time. But I have one quick question for you, and I need a really quick answer, which is, why did you get into this? What's your why?
Addictions impacted my family in many, many ways. And at the end of the day, as a physician, I always felt my duty was to treat those that need the most care. And in addiction, I found a career that I really have an opportunity to be part of people's lives that need it.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Kapoor, for being on.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Dr. Karane. Yes, I did it right.
Perfect.
Excellent. Perfect. Thank you so much. I always appreciate you coming. Again, Northwell Health has really stepped out and continue to bring excellence with this marriage of Northwell and Engel Bergman with the Wellbridge Center. I'm so excited about that. You can reach them and get more information at their website, www.wellbridgecare.com. Of course, you can go to northwell.edu always to find information about the opioid assistance that you could receive. Please reach out. I've been there. I know how it is. It's very frustrating. You have help. It's important to take it. In the meantime, thank you all for joining us today on Healthy Lifestyle. My heart is always lifted by sharing this time with you. Join us next time on Healthy Lifestyle so we can speak more on so many various topics. And remember, we're here to serve one another. Take a moment, step out of your day, do a little something for someone else. It will make you feel better, I promise. Remember, also do a little something for yourself every day. Just starts there. Create a new habit. It's a new balance that we're trying to find, and I know you're going to find it. Thank you again for joining us on Healthy Lifestyle. I'm Lori Ann Kasdia. Until next time, show up for you and show up big.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.